website, WBAI.org. My name is Michael G. Haskins, your radio host and guide. It's 1 o'clock in New York City. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille.
With you with The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. You know, one of those things that we get involved in nowadays in our society, one of those great difficult things is this whole idea of litigation, suing, lawyers. That whole thing, that legal world that we all want to avoid in some way or other, or many of us want to avoid. Well, I ran across a recent author, J. Craig Williams, wrote a book on the light with a kind of tongue-in-cheek, How to Get Sued. J. Craig is a good friend of a friend of mine, and when we looked a little closer, there was quite a bit of depth about the psychology of suing and getting sued, litigation, and all of that. Craig, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you, Armand. Appreciate you having me on the show.
Yeah, I'd like to. And Craig, let's get started. The psychology of litigation, the psychology of this whole idea of it. Let's talk to that.
Some people look at litigation like it's a sport. People that are fairly wealthy that have lost their perspective, I think, sometimes in life, turn to litigation as a means of entertaining themselves. And lawyers sometimes unwittingly, perhaps sometimes willingly, take a look at those kind of cases and say, you know, I'm don't have any work, so I'm going to get started in handling somebody that's doing this. It's a little difficult sometimes to analyze and understand why people file lawsuits. But I think in large part it has to do with your just inability sometimes to be able to have anything really to do in your life. So you turn to the courts because we've all seen the drama on television. We've all seen it in books. There's a long history of our country involved in litigation, all the way from even way back when the Redcoats shot the Boston colonists, and they went on trial for that, one of the very first trials in our young country.
Well, let's go back a little bit. Litigation can be a sport, but it could be a balancing act. I mean, there's a lot of litigation that we have used that has brought about a lot of things, in, like, you know, racial fairness and equal rights. It all came out of litigation.
Certainly. And there's a lot of safety that has come out of litigation. If you take a look back at the Ford Pinto litigation, I mean, one of the reasons that Ford got into so much trouble is because they knew that by putting the gas tank in the back of the car, they were going to endanger people. But they rationed that somehow it was less expensive to keep it there, and they'd run the risk of lawsuits. And someone found that memo, and it made it into court, and they got punished, and cars got changed. And since then, safety belts, airbags, all kinds of safety devices, harnesses that people wear when they work.
Okay, but Craig, let's back up for a minute. I know that in playlands nowadays, in playgrounds, right, they have rubberized grounds and they took away monkey bars. Now, monkey bars no longer exist. Why? Because of litigation. I can't tell you through my entire childhood, having grown up on monkey bars, which we had in our apartment at home. No, which were in the park across the street. But the monkey bars were there and nobody ever fell. And if you did fall, it was like you bunked your head. You know, I bunked my head and you came home and you were okay. But because of litigation, because of the threat that you could get sued, they took away monkey bars. So this, there's a good side of it, and I'm saying the good side of having litigation and having a legal system is it does bring fairness, it does have accountability, and it takes away the need to punch your neighbor in the nose, right? I mean, you know, it's kind of in the old days, how would Guido handle it? My cousin, he wouldn't use a lawyer.
He'd go solve it himself.
He'd go solve it himself. But the way instead is now we have this kind of mechanism now.
We've added intermediaries to the process.
That's right. And this is an intermediary. And the intermediary got complex because the intermediary used to be a go-between, but now it's complex. Now there are rules. Now there are laws. So what are some of the motivations that people have for bringing suit against other people?
Some people want vindication.
Vindication is a good word. Vindication, like they feel that they've been
wronged.
Wronged in some way.
And they want to be proved right.
I have a friend who has a business. He's had a business in New York for 20 years. And somebody came along and they opened a business with the very same name. His name hadn't been protected on the internet. And so they opened a business of the very same name. And he feels slighted by this. He feels wronged.
Yeah, and he should be. I mean, there are some laws that protect those kinds of things. There are trade secret laws and there are trademark laws and copyright laws that he can use to try and protect his interest in that.
But at the same time, somebody like that would also look at himself and say, you know, I should have copyrighted my name. I should have. And so what lawsuits sometimes do is they take away your looking at yourself as having not adequately prepared.
Right.
So there's vindication, and sometimes there's vindication for something about you that you just didn't pay attention to.
Yeah, and a lot of people look at ignorance of the law, you know, and say that the old adage is it's no excuse. But a lot of people will say, I just didn't know. How could I be expected with all of the things that are available in this world of the types of situations that come up? How can I be expected to know?
Could you give me an example of a place where people don't know a law exists?
Well, one of the ones I wrote about in the book and applies exactly here in New York, there was a gentleman by the name of Humberto Traveras who went out and took 8 or 9 people with him, I think it was maybe 10, to a restaurant. And you've always seen those things at the end of the menu that say, if you bring a big party, you have to tip 18%. Well, for him, food was terrible, service wasn't good, so he left only a 10% tip and got up and left the restaurant. This is on Long Island. The restaurant had him arrested. I'm not kidding. They had him arrested, and he had spent overnight in jail. The case went to trial, and the judge ruled that you are not obligated to tip. For 18%. If you don't like the service, it's up to you. There's no mandatory statute or rule in New York that requires you to do that. And but most people don't know that.
But how would you know?
You would not know that.
I didn't tip enough.
Yeah.
You know?
You think that you have to pay the 18% because it's there on the menu and somehow it's a contract that you've established with the restaurant because they gave you notice of it. But the courts don't think so.
This is Armand DeMille with you with A Positive Mind. We're speaking with J. Craig Williams, who is a lawyer who wrote a book called How to Get Sued, a good book because it's light and it tells you how to deal with real life, but how also to deal with litigation. And J. Craig is a very observation. He's a very observing man. He sees things. His perceptions, I think, are very valuable. There are two kinds of people get involved in lawsuits. There's the suer.
Right.
And there's the suee.
Plaintiff and the defendant.
Right. Now, we want to take it from both places today because many of you think about suing your neighbor. You think about suing the person next door. Give me an example of – so there are those and there are those that do not – who get sued. So let's talk for a moment about the people who do the suing. One motivation is vindication.
Another motivation might be vengeance or some type of revenge for something that's occurred. In the situation where someone has a tree overhanging the fence and they think that the apples are falling off and messing up their yard or something's going wrong or there's leaves that blow over on their property, and so they cut the tree down. They jump over the fence. This actually happened to one of our clients in California where I practice. Someone, a guy had a fantastic view of the ocean when he bought the house. 10 or 15 years went by, and the tree on the lower property that was in front of him grew up. It wasn't really trimmed, and it blocked his dining room bay window overlooking the ocean in Laguna Niguel. So he had his gardener jump over the fence, cut down the tree. At that point, the tree was so big, it was probably a, it was, they call them specimen trees. It's about a $50,000 or $60,000 tree to replace it, because you'd have to get cranes, and it grew for 30 years, and so there was an awful lot that was involved in it. Now, if he would have asked, the neighbor probably would have gone up and said, well, let's trim the tree down a little bit, let's shape it so that we can give you a view. Or as the tree was growing up, he could have said, you know, cut back the top, I want to have this view, and the neighbor probably would have been cooperative about it. But instead, cut down the whole tree. In those instances, I'm not really sure the motivation for doing that, other than just the selfish, perhaps selfish, maybe that's judgmental, but the perspective that I want to be able to have my view of the ocean, and I paid millions of dollars.
People with bent minds don't know what to do. I'll tell you something. I could tell you practically every man I know who gets involved in these kind of antagonistic relationships with other people over litigations that seem to be frivolous litigations is somebody who's got a chip on his shoulder.
Right.
And this chip is kind of manifesting, you know? Let me just get one thing clear. If you have a tree that's overgrowing on your property, do you have a right to cut down the part that's overgrowing your property and not touching your neighbor's part?
In California, where I practice, the answer to that question is yes. I'm not licensed in New York, so I don't know the answer to that question. But typically, from my experience in reading other states' laws, you can cut off the part that comes on your property over the fence.
But you got to leave theirs.
Yep.
Huh. So this is the kind of thing that you would check. But of course, you could talk to your neighbor.
Yeah, the easiest thing to do is just go sit down and say, look, this is coming over here. I don't want it over there, or I'd like to have a view, and the tree's grown. Is it possible? I'm happy to pay you for it. The easiest way to solve those problems is to talk to the person that you're involved with.
Litigation. People bring litigation for a few reasons. Sometimes it's vindication. Sometimes, like if you're a landlord who owns a building and you want to get a tenant out of the building, and even though they have a right to be in the building and they have rent control laws that are keeping them in the building and you want to get there, you sue them for things like garbage outside their house and you harass them.
Make their life miserable.
So this idea is another. Now that is, we could call greed as a motive.
Economics.
Or you could just say, that's it. You just did it. Economics. It may not be a matter of greed. It may just be a matter of economics. The guy says, if I get you out of my house, I make more money, so I'm going to try to get you out of my house. Now, even though we, the victims of that, will look at the landlord as being greedy, hey, he owns 4,000 houses. Why does he want to do it to me? It's really economics.
And it's it raises the philosophical question of who's in the better position to have the economics. Is it right for the landlord who owns the building to increase his wealth, or is the person who can't afford which is the idea behind rent control, who can't afford an increased rent, who gets moved out, economically has to suffer because when they find a new apartment, they've got to pay a higher rent? Those are questions that, you know, the courts don't deal with. They only look at the issue of, you know, did you take your garbage out? Did you do what the landlord has alleged that you did? And if you violated the terms of your lease, then you may be booted out.
Well, I think we're a little different in New York. I think we lean a little more towards the person in residence, you know?
We do in California as well in rent control areas. We have an area in Santa Monica that is heavily rent controlled, and that is definitely the leaning there. It's very difficult to get a tenant moved out of a rent control apartment.
Yeah, people get afraid of it, you know? And I'm going to get sued. You're going to get sued is one of these things that terrify people.
I'll see you in court.
Well, the idea of using as an intimidation, I'll sue you. I mean, it's one of the things I know for sure. Never tell anybody you're going to sue them. Either sue them or don't sue them.
Right.
Because you could be triggering off a whole series of counter, You know, so if you're going to do it, do it. If you're not going to do it, don't threaten it, because threatening it doesn't make much of a difference unless you think you're intimidating somebody with it. So there's another reason to use a threatened lawsuit: intimidation.
Intimidation tends to work fairly well, because usually what will happen is if the landlord or someone else intends to sue you or just simply wants to threaten, you send what we call a demand letter. And you say, I'm going to sue you if you don't do A, B, C, D. And then as a consequence of that, the person either does it or doesn't do it and then gets potentially sued. But all lawyers look at litigation, and when you get sued, they'll usually bring a counterclaim against the person that did the suing.
So this is the new way of dealing with this guy in the middle, right? In the old days, I'll beat you up, you'll beat me up. Okay, we get away from that. I'm going to get my cousin to beat you up. Now you put somebody on the outside. I'll get my cousin to beat you back up. We get that out of the way. I have this man. We call him a lawyer. He's not going to beat up anybody, but he's going to present the case between the two of you. Okay, we now have a negotiant. We have an abogado. We have a guy in the middle. And then that goes further with that. Now this guy is now going to be used as my weapon. We're now going to use him to intimidate you, to do things with you. And what you get now is you get a counter lawyer. Now you get a lawyer on the other side. And what that lawyer does is not just respond to you, but the new battle is countersuit.
Right. And suddenly we're back to where we were in the Bible when Solomon had to make a decision. He's going to do what? Split the baby. And that's generally what happens when courts – that's why lawyers bring counter lawsuits against other people that sue, because they think, well, if I have a good defense, the best way to do that is a strong offense, so I'm going to bring a counterclaim, make the case look like there's some allegations on one side, and we're going to tip the scale with some more allegations on the other side, potentially try and balance the two of them so that they offset each other, and potentially – and I've seen it happen many times in litigation because I've been doing it a long time. And defendants will sometimes win on those counterclaims because the jury or the judge thinks that the person that's the suing is overreaching.
The judge usually believes that a person who is suing is overreaching?
Not usually. But there are cases where a plaintiff will overreach in a lawsuit and make a claim that is outlandish. And they'll get punished. I mean, if you go back to, I think, the issue we talked about before the show briefly about personal responsibility, one of the things that I see happening in cases is that the person who's willing to say, you know, I'm sorry, I have some responsibility in this, and I'll accept that responsibility. Juries like that because they think, well, we don't need to teach this person a lesson. We don't need to point the finger and knock him down a peg or two and bring him back to reality because he's accepted responsibility or she's accepted responsibility. But sometimes the people on the other side of the lawsuit will not let go, and they won't apologize for their own role in the mishap. There's a kind of a common understanding among lawyers that the truth is generally somewhere in the middle between the suee and the suer. And I think you probably see this in your practice as well when you have people come in. People have their own perspective and their own observations. I'll go back to one of the first-year classes I had in law school. And there's 25 bright, smart, sharp young people eager to learn. We've got our notebooks out. We're taking notes for an hour in the class and going on and on. At the end of the class, the professor puts something up on the blackboard and he says, well, did the person that came in the beginning of the class hand me something, take something away? Were they wearing clothes? Was it a man? Was it a woman? Were they dark? Were they light? Did a person even come in at all? Half the class didn't even think that anybody came in because we weren't there for that lesson. We were there to learn criminal law. And we didn't quite get it that we were learning criminal law because we weren't observant enough to see who it was that came in, what they brought, what they took, what they were wearing, how tall they were, how short they were, how fat they were, what their characteristics. We just weren't observant enough. And it was embarrassing to all of us to not be that observant. But it taught us a great lesson that witnesses who come into court and testify from their own perspective. People that sue sue from their own perspective. They have a viewpoint that is in their mind, and they bring it forth in the lawsuit. The defendant comes in, and they present the opposite side of the case, and it's up to someone who wasn't even there during the event to try and sort out what happened, who's responsible, who should pay. And it's kind of unfair to that judge or that jury to make a judgment based on testimony that may or may not be completely reliable.
But, you know, it's like, who wants to be involved in this? I mean, I have a good friend, Ricky Rohr, who advises all the time, don't ever go there. She says, litigation, you don't want to be in it.
No.
You know, I was a post-fire. I was post-fire trying to sue a landlord one time for a thing of negligence. It was 3 years. 3 years of presenting and back and forth and going into your life. Do you agree with that? You agree? If you could just stay out of it, stay out of it.
That's the best advice that I can give anybody. In fact, when people come into my office, you know, certainly I want to sit and listen to what they have to say and analyze the facts and apply the law to their situation to see if there's a resolution. But what I try to do first is encourage some type of discussion with the other side, because ultimately at the end of the lawsuit, either in a settlement conference or when the jury finally gets done with you, you're going to hear it. So after you've spent thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars, why not talk to the person in the beginning of the case, get their perspective, offer your perspective, and see if there's some resolution.
We're talking with J. Craig Williams, who is a lawyer in California, not soliciting business here in New York. He wrote a book called How to Get Sued, which I think is delightful but also very informative, which is about what happens during a lawsuit. You know, I know of somebody, Craig, recently, who said that he bumped into somebody's car, or his daughter bumped into somebody's car, and it caused a little dimple on the fender. The woman says, I'm going to sue you for my deductible, which is $1,000, so I'm suing you for $999 for the dimple on my car. And she said, if you want to avoid a lawsuit, you better settle on this somewhere around $500 now. The threat of the lawsuit and the threat of and the kind of interesting perspective of the parent was the following. He said, let her sue you. Let her bring to court an overstatement, because by doing that, she's committing a crime. Now, that was a fascinating, fascinating perspective. That, you know, on some level, she is going to commit a crime by making a claim that's not true. Does that hold up? Is there such a thing as perjuring just by bringing a lawsuit that's not true?
You have to have a good faith basis to believe the allegations in your lawsuit. And in California, where we sign pleadings, we sign them not under penalty of perjury, but we sign them under local rules and federal rules that require us to make a representation to the court that we've done an adequate investigation of the facts and we're presenting a legitimate claim to the court. When you submit a statement to the court, either in a declaration or in sworn testimony, if you lie, you've committed perjury. And perjury is a crime, and you can be held in contempt of court. You can even be jailed as a consequence of presenting false testimony to the court. On a civil basis, it constitutes fraud. It's a misrepresentation of a fact, and you can be held civilly liable for that.
So exaggerating the damages in a suit that you're bringing to so that you might settle for less does put you in jeopardy somewhere down the line of fraud, of having presented yourself as a fraudulent.
And we already know this. I mean, we were taught by our rabbis. We were taught by our priests and our ministers and our grandparents and our fathers. Don't over-exaggerate. Tell the story.
But, you know, I'll tell you something, Craig. I went to a friend of mine had another auto story. They had a little bump on their car, and they brought it to a repairman, and the repairman said, I'll send it into your insurance. And he and the adjuster were in each other's pocket, and he sent out a claim for $7,000, which was for about something that was about $500 worth of repair. The insurance company paid the $7,000 to this fraudulent repairman who was going to do all the things he said he was going to do, but it only needed $500 worth of work. My friend said, I don't want to be involved in this. I don't want to be involved. My insurance company is paying $7,000. I don't want to be involved in this fraud, even though it doesn't cost me a cent, even though the guy said, and I'll throw in new seats for you just as a bonus, you know, to keep your mouth shut.
Right.
Do you think that maybe we are all complicit in some way because we also want to take advantage of little bends in the law where we don't, you know, where we could get some little greedy benefit? And maybe if people started straightening out their own lives and their own ethics about this, we could at least start making a difference.
I agree with you, but I don't think that's a bend in the law. I think that's a break. I mean, that's just
but
out
every,
and out
you know,
fraud.
Every auto repair shop seems to do this with every guy who comes in to be an adjuster.
Right.
Maybe. And I mean, I'm sure some adjuster is going to call me and say, I don't do that.
No, and I'm sure that there are some auto repair shops that don't do it either. But for those that do, that is actually a crime. And, you know, those cases get prosecuted and those people get put in jail. And we've seen that with the recent spate of CEOs that are doing the same thing. They're looting big companies, taking money away from shareholder investors. So,
and Medicare also, you know, legally, people present claims. You know, you go see your doctor and your doctor submits tests that you never did. And you get a chance to see what tests were done and what tests were not done. And they see that they tested you for beriberi or something like that that you had no interest in whatsoever and charged the insurance company and Medicare paid them off. And this fraud just continues all the way down the line because the doctors aren't getting reimbursed enough. So they overcharge.
Right.
And you're supposed to keep quiet. And because it doesn't cost you anything.
And I don't think you are. I think that you owe a duty to society and to the rest of us who are having to pay higher insurance premiums because of that kind of behavior to say, enough of that. I'm gonna let somebody know. I'm going to call the U.S. attorney. I'm going to call the district attorney. Or I'm just going to let the insurance company know and let them investigate it. You know, sometimes, though, when people go to authority, the government sometimes doesn't pay attention to you. And they think you're a crackpot. You come in with some kind of a claim like that and they say, you know, go away. There's not enough of this. And, you know, but one thing that happens, if there's enough reports about Dr. X or insurance company A, then if the government agencies still continue to see that time and time again, somebody's going to investigate that.
So some of us, we have a social responsibility to our society, if we want to curb this thing that's happening, to try to work for justice, even if it's a little inconvenience, but not necessarily through litigation. You know, we could stop some of what's going on. Now, I want to talk, when we get back from our break, we're going to take a short break. And when I get back from the break, I want to talk about the experience of being sued, of the experience of having a lawsuit brought against you, which so many people fear. And I want to talk about the kinds of things that you could do and should do immediately as you hear about it. I mean, I got sued for something once that had nothing to do with me, and I called my friend who was a lawyer. He said, what are you worried about? He said, I'll take care of it for you. He said, it's nothing. And it got to a point where I felt eventually as I grew up that lawsuits aren't frightening. You know, IRS isn't frightening. These things aren't frightening. They're just
life.
Just life.
Right.
And it doesn't mean you're bad. It doesn't mean it's a crime. So we're going to look at all of that. This is Armand DeMille with you. And the name of the book, in case you have to go, is How to Get Sued, S-U-E-D, by J. Craig Williams. Brilliant man. I kind of like that. When we get back, as we said, we're going to take a look at some of this some of the things that happen to you that make you feel so powerless and so helpless as we, whenever somebody says, I'm suing you, when they bring something against you. Because you can't live in fear of it. If you are going to be somebody who is going to be in this world, part of the adult world is dealing with the legal system. Dealing with the legal system is just like part of what you do. I know one person who had a hustler came along and sued this one person for being a doctor and said that she did something wrong, being a psychologist and did something wrong. And she was so affected by the suit itself, which was he was just a hustler, he just wanted money, that she cracked under the strain, gave up her business. I want to talk about why that happens to certain people. We will be back with you in just a couple of minutes, my friends. This is Armand DeMille. Be back shortly.
Hi, this is Lloyd Price, and you're tuned to WBAI New York. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
Okay.
Oh, now, Lordy, 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 Miss Claudia. Girl, you sure look good to me. Well, please don't excite me, baby. No, it can't.
All right.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis,
okay, I'm on.
And, of
here
course,
we
your
go.
Comments, questions,
five,
and observations.
Four,
that's TalkBack
three,
right here on
two,
WBAI
one,
New York.
Go.
Listening to Big Daddy Rogers, Big Daddy Rogers, from Soul Classics, Be My Lawyer Baby. Be My Lawyer Baby? Where did we get this from? I don't know, you know, just about anywhere. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're talking about the psychology of law, how to get sued, what happens from the book How to Get Sued by J.H. Craig Williams. Craig, I want to talk about emotions. And I want to talk about emotions. And, you know, lawyers kind of, I understand, they're thinking people. That's the idea of being a lawyer. You think.
When people say to us, what do you feel? The first words out of a lawyer's mouth is, well, I think.
Right, because it's not, you're not about your feelings. It's about what you think and what you perceive. And what you perceive and think and what you might want to deal with, you know, in some way. If it's like it's like it's
it's basically what you perceive is going to be reported. So, but it doesn't mean that you guys don't feel, and you don't have to defend it. I mean, I know feeling lawyers. But the question is, it's about what you think. But when you get sued, something happens. When somebody brings a lawsuit against you, and people become, some people, I guess there is a range of reactions. Can you tell me the range of emotional reactions that people have?
It ranges from absolute fear and to the point sometimes where people can't do anything. I mean, typically in a lawsuit, you'll get 30 days to respond to it. And I've had clients that have come in 45, 60 days later and just have said, I have not been able to deal with this. I can't touch the paper. I can't look at it. I don't know what to do with it. They're completely intimidated by it, and they're fearful of owning up to whatever it is that the lawsuit is alleging.
Okay, so let's look at the chemical basis of humanity and our what brought us here. When someone is attacked, their response can be aggression, so you could get angry.
Right.
Or you can become very frightened, and in that fear you could become immobile, right? As many animals do, like the deer in the hut in the headlights. Or very often, what I see happen to people is they become obsessive. They can't get it out of their mind. When you have somebody suing you, you almost can't sleep at night. It's like one friend of mine described it. It's like a song that won't leave your head. You know, you remember the last song that won't leave your head?
I don't want to even say it because I'm so afraid to hear it.
I'm afraid to hear the song.
Because I live near Disneyland and I'm thinking of that song.
Oh, that song. I had a couple in my life. I went to see Jersey Boys. They had a whole bunch in there that just, they're still in my mind, but they're still nice. It's one that won't leave.
Right.
Well, that becomes obsessive. Do you have a song? I'm looking at Stephanie in the studio. Stephanie, bro, you got a song that you're afraid to think of because it's going to go off in your head? Oh, my God. We got to make a list of songs and then burn them or something. I had one. Oof. I won't even go there. Okay, so the idea of a lawsuit is you're being sued. So now you're under attack. Somebody's attacking you. They want to take things away from you. When you are being sued, someone wants something from you. They're not just punishing you. They want you to give them something that you have. It's probably money, right? Always money.
Typically money. Sometimes it's an apology.
But they don't sue you for an apology.
No.
What do you demand? I demand an apology.
You demand money. And if it's in a criminal matter, you may be demanding some time from them to put them in jail.
Well, you can't sue somebody on a criminal matter.
Only the district attorney or the U.S. attorney can.
So let's go with what a kind of a suit that another person might bring against you. The punishment is money, or they can get an action out of you. You must move out of the neighborhood.
Right.
You got to move out of the building.
Or you must stop doing something.
Or you have to stop doing something. Or you can't. Like recently, the city sued people in New York who had their doors open and they were air conditioned, because they said it was burning up too much energy, and so everybody has to shut their door or they're going to get punished. You know what I mean? So the reactions, the emotional reaction you get is frightened. Some people get frightened. Other people get angry. Any people ever walk in and say, oh, I'm being sued, I'd like you to handle this, and they don't seem like it's taking an emotional toll on them?
And it's frightening because as a lawyer, you see this. I mean, I see it all the time, and so I'm desensitized to it. But as an individual, I would like to see some type of emotional reaction because I expect some level of a range. I mean, it's normal to have a reaction, whether it's fear or whether it's aggression or anything arranged in between. What frightens me the most are those people that come in and just take it in stride. They've never been sued before, and there have been several instances, and I know there have been some here in New York, and I've got some friends in California that have been people have brought guns in and shot lawyers or shot the opposing party as a way to deal with getting rid of the lawsuit. They're so aggressive that they decide to take the law into their own hands and injure the person.
But there's emotion there.
There's a definite emotion.
I mean, there's definite emotion. You're talking about people. There are a group of people who take it like it's just a part of life. But I think at this point in my life, if I were sued, I would probably take it fairly casually. You know, I mean, it's like, all right, so we're in the system.
Right.
We'll deal with this. I think there's another emotional factor, though. I think the people who fear being sued the most are people who have a great deal of shame underneath in their personality. Shame for having done something wrong as children. Shame for being broken and not being a normal person. They have a shame base. And they have this shame base so that when somebody points a finger at them, they think that it's justified. And they think that they are getting punished for all the things that they've ever done that they've gotten away with.
Well, Neil Diamond is the one who said what he paid his wife, $150 million. And his response to it is she earned every penny of it. And I think he may be one of those people that feels ashamed of what he put his wife through and uses the money as a means to salve that wound.
So he was saying, I feel that shame. Well, I think a lot of people have a lot of shame that are not based on the incident that's taking place. So if you're suing me for having my garbage can out front, but I feel that as a child I was wrong to my parents, I may feel crippled or overreactive to that lawsuit because in some way I have this fear that I'm going to be punished. A lot of people fear they're going to be punished by God. A lot of people fear they're going to be punished by their parents.
And there is that word judgment.
Well, what is that word? Let's talk about it. That's such an interesting word.
It comes at the end of every lawsuit, and ultimately it is your comeuppance. It's the time when you have to answer for whatever the allegations are in the lawsuit. And it's out of your hands. You lose control over it. You give that control to the judge, or you give that control to 12 jurors in a New York State jury, or in federal court, 6 jurors. You're going to be – someone is going to sit in judgment of you. Now, it's – yes, God's
going to – Well, they're not in judgment of you. They're in judgment of the merits, right?
They're in judgment of your actions. But people who have that sense of shame that you're talking about that's deep inside, they may feel like – they're getting judged by God right here and now. And that is either a fear or may create some aggression by them or just may cause them, as you said about the person that you knew, cause them to just snap and break.
A person, when a person gets involved in some kind of litigation, the attorneys almost invariably are pressing for some kind of settlement because most attorneys don't like an all or nothing situation.
No, and there was an article in the New York Times, I think it was last week, it came out that said that you do better, both as a plaintiff and a defendant in a settlement, than you do in trial. So it's better to do that one in the hand instead of not knowing what's ultimately going to happen.
Right, but if you feel just,
then you should pursue it, and you should stand up for your rights because there have been people. There's, you know, you look at Brown versus Board of Education, you know, the lawsuit that resulted in the desegregation of schools. And a lot of people at the time, especially in the South, didn't think that that was an appropriate lawsuit to be brought and that that was something that God didn't ordain and, you know, the society is as it should be right now and there shouldn't be any changes. But those kind of changes are going to occur. There's going to be unpopular lawsuits and unpopular lawyers and righteous people that need to pursue and persevere and present their case because they believe it's right.
I think one of the mistakes that people make emotionally, Craig, is that people kind of look and they expect the lawyer to be their savior. They want the lawyer to be their daddy.
Oh, there's a lot of fixers as lawyers. There are a lot of savior complexes and rescue people out there acting as lawyers.
Oh, well, there are also lawyers acting as rescuers. You know what I mean? There's both.
Right.
And it kind of always gets me. You know what always gets me when a divorcee is having an affair with a lawyer after a divorce? And I see the savior lawyer who, you know, he now helps her through her divorce and now she becomes his savior and he has a brief affair with her. Is that, but there's nothing against that, right? There's no.
There definitely is, yes.
There's a law against it?
There's an ethical rule against it.
What's the rule?
You
if
cannot,
it's after the divorce?
You cannot have sex with a client. The sex cannot relate to the matter or you can't use it as payment for services provided.
Ever?
Well, technically, I mean, the rule technically says that once the lawsuit is over, but any good lawyer that is going to have a solid sense of ethics will probably do the same as a psychotherapist or a psychologist, which is never have sex or a relationship with that client because you don't know the extent of when that relationship ends. I mean, you can send a letter that says that the case is over with or a judgment can exist, but there's an appeal period. There's all kinds of things that can occur later that may result in you having to represent that person again. And it's a dangerous thing to do, much as it is in your profession.
Mm-hmm. But of course, it's very common.
Yes, as it is with ministers and rabbis and people that are involved
sure.
in one-on-one personal relationships with people where someone has provided some type of ultimate care and resolution of a problem, then there's a bond that gets
So developed. You expect your attorney to be your good daddy or your good mommy, if it's a woman attorney, and you expect that they are going to take care of you. And when you find out that they're part of the old boys club, you know, where you have an attorney and you're in the middle of some kind of litigation and you see your attorney going over to the opposing attorney and they're kind of hanging on with each other and having drinks and playing golf, and you know he's not going to fight for you to a certain point because this is his buddy, and he says to you, oh, I think we're going to do very well because I play golf with the judge. Well, I don't know if that's – do I want a lawyer who plays golf with the judge?
Well, there's an old adage that a good lawyer knows the law and a great lawyer knows the judge. But, you know, after you've been in practice for a period of time, you know, it's like you said about lawsuits. You know, you've reached the point in your life where you're not afraid of being sued. Well, when I first started to practice law 20-some years ago, I think I was intimidated by judges. I mean, they're the black robe and they were sitting higher in the courtroom and they had the authority. And so that was an intimidating thing for me. And I showed a lot of respect when I talked to judges. Well, now I've gotten to know the judges. I've gotten to experience the talking with them and being in front of them on a frequent basis. And I know a lot of judges. I'm a lot more comfortable. And I don't think I would ever say to a client that you're going to win the case because I know the judge. Because if that's the case, you really don't want that lawyer. You want the lawyer that knows the judge, but the judge is going to make a fair decision.
How do you feel about attorneys who are part of the old boys club where they know each other so much? I mean, you know you're not going to take on your friend because your case is going to disappear and those guys got to live with each other.
Well, you know, we all know each other. I mean, we've all been in practice for a while. We all go to bar functions and we all see each other in court all the time and we all establish a relationship with one another. It's a natural course of being.
So even when you have an antagonistic relationship during a lawsuit where you are opposing an attorney or a district attorney or somebody and you're fighting with each other and you're doing all this positioning, at the end of the lawsuit you just kind of put it aside because it was all acting?
And it's an amazing thing to do that because lawyers pigeonhole. You know, we compartmentalize and we tend to take – we adopt our clients' personas when we talk. I mean there's a transference that goes on because when I talk to another lawyer and I'm talking about my client, I speak in the first person and so does that other lawyer. When we talk to each other, we talk to each other like we are our clients. Well, you did this to me, and I did that to you, and then this happened, and because it's shorthand for us to be able to deal with one another. And we adopt and transfer our clients' situations into our own heads and engage in that back and forth. Now, yes, there are certainly lawyers that are adversarial and difficult. And frankly, the lawyers that are adversarial and difficult with, I am not friends with. I will not go out after the lawsuit and have a beer. I mean, there are a lot of lawyers that I don't want to talk to because of the way that they've behaved in litigation. But for someone who's professional, ethical, intelligent, more than happy to do it. But I'm not going to do it at the expense of my client. But at the same time, when I finish that case, I've got to get that client back out of my head. I've got to eliminate that transference because I've got to adopt another persona for another client.
Unless they hum that tune.
Oh, no kidding.
And if they hum that same song, it just never leaves.
There are some clients that I will never forget.
Right.
And that tune plays in my head.
Over and over again.
Over and over again.
Let me ask you quickly, since we have a short period of time. Craig, J. Craig Williams, the name of the book is How to Get Sued. Craig, people have marriages, and the marriages are difficult, and a lot of people are electing to get out of the marriage. The woman says, I'm going to get a lawyer. The man says, I'm going to get a lawyer. The man says, we should have one lawyer. The woman says, I think we should have separate lawyers. Sometimes. And then there's this thing called a shark. You could get this lawyer because he's a shark, because he'll rip your husband's heart out. And the other person says, you should get this lawyer because he's a negotiator. What's the story there? Those sharks, the ones who are going to go after and rip and decimate your husband because you're angry at him, are those guys respectable guys, or are they just mean-hearted rats?
They're mean-hearted rats, and there's a couple other words that are among the seven dirty words that I can't say on radio, but or television. But they're going to spend your money.
You don't want to mix in with them. You don't want to be a part of that.
They are going to spend your money, and at the end, unless you have a lot to give away and you can afford to play a sport with litigation, I would say to stay away from that. There's a new movement called collaborative divorce. Collaborative mediation, and there's a way that lawyers can help resolve the problem between the two of you, potentially even keep you married. I mean, the divorce rate is above 50%, which just blows my mind. But the one lawyer is a dangerous thing to do for two people, because who does that lawyer owe a duty to?
Favor, right.
Yeah. And
well, how about a negotiator then? But, arbitrator. Don't they do the same thing?
They do the same thing, but you recognize that you go into it knowing that that person is a mediator or an arbitrator or some type of a collaborative person who's going to try and resolve the issues.
But if a guy says, hey, I've got a friend of mine at the gym who's an arbitrator, we'll hire him, you know, that's not the best choice.
No, it's not, because you want to get someone who's neutral, who doesn't have a relationship with one side or the other that's going to favor them. But, you know, divorce is a highly emotional situation.
Yes, it is.
And it generally is triggered by some type of adultery or some type of affair or money situation. And there's that high emotional situation that sometimes needs a cathartic release in dealing with letting the shark go after the husband or the wife and crucify me. And look at Trisha Waldo Smith, who got on and just prattled on about how she thought that she was entitled to have these kinds of things. And the rest of us looked at her and said, you know, woman, no, you're not entitled to it. And she didn't get any kind of relief. But there are other women and other men who have been violated and who feel a need for some type of redemption or some type of vengeance or some emotional outlet. And they'll hire that shark because they want that person, and they'll spend that money to go after and then feel, well, okay, good. I landed a couple of punches.
But the matter is, if you're trying to start a new life and you're trying to get away from somebody who you consider has hurt you and abused you in some form, emotionally, neglect or anything, and then the way you do it is you go and you get associated with somebody who's a mean-spirited guy.
Guess what you are?
Yeah, guess where it's putting you.
And, you know,
You're joining the crowd.
Your show is called The Positive Mind. And I know that when you go to punch someone or get vengeance, your fists are closed. And when you try to open yourself and let things go, you naturally have to open your arms and open your hands and let that out of you so that you can move on to the next phase of your life. If you've made a choice to move on, then frankly, I think you just ought to let that man or let that woman go and deal with the monetary issues the best way possible, but move on to the new part of your life and close that chapter and get through that catharsis, whether it's through some type of psychological counseling or grief counseling or dealing with the loss that you've experienced, because that's really what it is. You've lost that part of your life that you had included, and you've got to let it go. And lawsuits, apart from divorce, are a lot about loss, because as you said, someone wants something from someone else, so you have to part. The other party is going to have to part. If someone gets, someone has to give.
Well, that's very wise. J. Craig Williams, How to Get Sued. Thank you very much for being with us. I think if you get back in town, I'd like to do this again. There's a lot of other questions I'd like to have. You have a website, don't you?
I do. It's called howtogetsued.com. And if any of your listeners do end up in a lawsuit, there's a free chapter that you can download that's not in the book. You can download it from the internet on howtogetsued.com. And it deals with what to do if you do get sued, how to hire a lawyer, what steps to take, what expenses you're going to have, what to expect. And each one of the chapters at the end of this book has a section called Seriously Now, Lessons Learned. So I really mean for – and your audience is right up – directed to who this book is directed to. It's an intelligent audience that I'm looking for, and there's a moral to each one of these little vignettes that are in here. And the morals are summed up at the end about how to avoid litigation, because it's a lighthearted way of saying how to get sued really is a way to how to avoid getting sued and how to navigate life and the kinds of things that you go through to deal with not getting sued. The lessons in this book will show people how to avoid that.
Thanks a lot, Craig. Thanks for being with us. How long are you going to be in New York? You're going to be on TV soon?
Yep, tonight.
Where are you going to be?
I'm going to be in Long Island. I don't have the TV station in front of me, but I'll be on Long Island in a TV show. I was on Joey Reynolds earlier this week.
We're proud to have you here. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
This is Armand DeMille. Be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. A copy of this program is available at thepositivemind.com. You could also send me an email through that. Thank you, friends.